Greetings and welcome to our second class, Radical Practice for Difficult Times, exploring the teachings of the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. Let's plunge in right away by finding ourselves seated around the magical lake, Lake Manasarovar, the great lake of consciousness. So you can feel yourself seated on the banks of the deep blue lake. This lake is high in the Himalayan mountains. You can see snow-capped peaks all around you. Seated around the lake with us are all the beings in this community. There are about 250 of us. And if you like, you can also imagine friends and family, people that you hold in your heart, seated around the lake with you. And as you firm your posture, breathing in so that the base of the posture becomes heavy and grounded and sinks into the seat, and as the torso lifts with the exhalation up through the crown, you can bring your awareness into the heart. Feel your own heart, the rhythm of your own heart, and also sense the hearts of all the others who are seated here with us. In your cupped hands, you hold a candle. And using the magical power that you have suddenly acquired to emit a flame from your right forefinger, you light the candle. And then holding it in your cupped hands, you create an intention for yourself, for this evening of practice. And here's my intention. May our practice uplift us. May it carry us farther in our journey of enlightenment. May it give us wisdom, comfort, and peace in this difficult time. May it enable us to be of help to others. May all beings benefit from what we're doing here together. And now we'll chant the opening invocation, three recitations of Om, then our invocation of the inner teacher, who is also the great light of consciousness, Shiva, and our invocation to the primordial goddess. You can place your hands in Anjali Mudra, or you can place your right hand over your sternum, your left hand over that, and feel the connection between your palms and the heart. Om. 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 Om Namah Shivaya Gurave Sachit Ananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase Sarva Mangala Mangalye Shive Sarvatra Sadike Sharanye Trayambake Gauri Narayani Namostute. And now the traditional invocation mantras to the sage Patanjali. Vande Gurunam Charanaravinde Sandarshita Swatma Sukhavabodhe Nishreyase Jangalikayamane Samsara Hala Hala Moha Shantyai Abhahu Purushakaram Shankha Chakra Siddharinam Sahasra Shiri Samshvetam Pranamami Patanjalim Pranamami Patanjalim Pranamami Patanjalim. Your awareness now attends to the breath, and as the breath flows in very naturally, flows out very naturally through the nostrils, as you sense the touch of the breath on the nostrils, the coolness coming in, the warmth flowing out, have the feeling that your consciousness, your attention, your awareness is sinking like a pebble to the surface of the lake, falling down, down, down through the clear, limpid blue waters until it rests on the bottom of the lake. This is the lake of consciousness. So as you rest on the bottom, your breath draws in particles of blue light, of the blue light of consciousness. And your feeling is of immense stillness. Allow yourself to take rest in this moment on the very floor of the lake of consciousness. as you are breathed by the prana, by the energy, by the light of the lake.
Love and blessings to all of us. And I just want to start with a story, which is one of my favorite stories about focused, concentrated practice, which actually is what we're focusing on right now. There was once a tantric practitioner who had meditated for years with a particular mantra in order to summon and harness a spirit. You know, one of the things that some tantric traditions do is work with spirits, summoning them and then commanding them and kind of using the spirits as a way of harnessing different kinds of power. So this guy was doing his sadhana one day when all of a sudden the spirit he was invoking appeared. And, you know, the spirit is standing in the air in front of him, and it's a huge, huge spirit with a big belly, sharp teeth, a kind of a scary demeanor. And the spirit folds his hands and says, "Master, I am here to serve you. I will do anything you ask, but I just have to tell you one thing. If there is any moment when you don't have a task for me, I will eat you." So this story contains its own warning about summoning spirits. But in any case, the yogi had lots of work for the spirit, and he welcomed him into his life, and then he said, "Build me a house." So the spirit then proceeded to conjure up bricks and boards to build him a beautiful house, which the yogi gave him instructions for, but it only took the spirit 2 hours to complete the house. And then there he was with his hands folded saying, "Give me a job." So the yogi said, "Okay, landscape the property," which the spirit did in an hour and a half. Came back, folded his hands, "Any job for me, master?" The spirit said, "Go to the market and bring enough food for a feast, and then cook the feast, and then invite everyone that we know in the village, serve the feast." And this happened. And so a couple of days went by. The yogi managed to find tasks for the spirit. And then there came a moment when he couldn't think of a thing for the spirit to do. And at that moment, the spirit read his inability to assign a task in the yogi's eyes. And he came towards him saying, "All right, this is it, dude, I'm going to eat you." And the yogi had the presence of mind to rush into the house and call his guru. The spirit had also installed cell phone service in his village. And he told the guru what to do. I mean, he told the guru what was happening. The guru said, "Okay, here's what to do. Tell the spirit to put up a pole in the front yard and then command him to run up and down the pole. Tell him that whenever you don't have work for him, his job is to run up and down the pole." And it worked. For the rest of the yogi's life, the spirit ran up and down the pole except when the yogi had something for him to do. And the yogi survived, and to complete a very powerful yogic sadhana, and to terrorize the entire neighborhood with his yogic powers, but that's another story. So as you probably figured out, the spirit represents the untamed mind, which is so useful in life, but which can also cause an enormous amount of suffering. And the pole, of course, represents yogic practice, specifically the practice of concentrative sadhana, which can anchor the mind and keep it from running amok. And we could say that the sages who compiled the Yoga Sutras wanted to give us a sense of how many practices there are that can anchor the mind and train it. And at the core of their instruction is this understanding that we need to tether the mind, at least initially, to the pole of practice. As our practice deepens, the pole becomes less necessary. But the practice pretty much never does. And last week, in the sutras that we worked with, we followed the intention of the sutras to show us the baseline of this approach to practice. That is, how to get mastery of the thought waves, the vrittis, so that the outgoing and thought-clogged fabric of the citta, your consciousness, can become transparent to its source, the luminous self. And it then goes on to say that the core of the method, which actually applies to every serious spiritual and practice path, is cultivating your capacity for one-pointed concentration, which starts when we put our attention on something and which deepens until we become able to experience the deep peace that the yoga tradition calls samadhi. The word samadhi has several definitions. It's a fairly mysterious word, and it's, of course, core to the Patanjali tradition. It comes from the word, the syllable dha, D-H-A, which means holding, which connects to another Sanskrit word, dharana, that we'll be talking about later on in the course, meaning the capacity to maintain such pure focus on an object that the scattered, fractured particles of consciousness, the fractionated consciousness, come together and turn towards the pure self. And the part of the mind that emerges, or that actually does the practice, that, you know, that emerges when the mind becomes focused and absorbed, is called the D-H-I, meaning the higher mind, the mind that is honed through concentration. Sama in this context means super. So samadhi is the super concentration of the higher mind, where all thoughts and desires dissolve in the light. And in the light of the self, as we said last week, and as we've been discussing, a lot of people on the listserv have been discussing this issue, in the light of the self, the vrittis dissolve. And along with the vrittis, the deeper samskaras, the impressions that are left in consciousness by our repetitive vrittis, and also the deep, deep samskaric traces, which we call vasanas, the tendencies that color the mind, that create the style of our energy and our personality. And of course, when we start to meditate, and a lot of you have been describing experiences of this during the week, when we start to meditate, especially in the light of the very intense shakti that is unleashed in this class, and through the coming together of all of you, you know, because most of you here are pretty advanced souls with pretty concentrated consciousness. So there's a lot of shakti that's generated from many sources in this class and in the experience that you're having when you meditate in this class and in your at-home practice. So these vrittis start to come up, and then we're given the opportunity to work with them, which all the practices that we're doing in this course actually help us, you know, they help us get very skilled in working with vrittis, samskaras and vasanas. Yet at the same time, when we're just starting to sit regularly, I know this is true for some of you, and also when we sit for longer or when we meditate in the context such as the one we're meditating in now or in a retreat context, very often the uprush of samskaras is quite intense. And, you know, we begin to become aware of all the dreck that lies right below the surface of awareness. I would also like to call your attention to the posting that Karen Prentice offered today on the listserv, which is a really exquisite account of the experience that she had this week, in which, because of an illness, sort of a configuration of circumstances, she began to do a deep practice of looking into the buried vasanas and samskaras that not only seemed to be germane to her illness, but also to a lot of the stuckness that she experienced in life. And she describes a very powerful and radical release opening, which I think a lot of you, certainly me, found quite inspiring. So one of the reasons that the practice that we're doing takes a while, why samadhi or full absorption takes a while, is because it happens in stages. And since most of us are fairly distracted, we're not all that good at keeping ourselves focused over time. And, you know, so practicing meditation and practicing asana or practicing any powerful yogic modality is often a matter of focusing, then being overrun by thoughts or distractions or, you know, something that happens in the room that calls our attention, and then bringing ourselves back to the point of focus, letting go of the distraction. One of my friends once described the process of meditation as alternating between focus and letting go, focus and letting go. And interestingly enough, the word focus points to the word abhyasa, which is the Sanskrit word for steady practice directed towards a peaceful mind, and vairagya, the process, the practice of letting go of distractions. And I also want to just make a point here, also in response to some of the sharing that's come in on the listserv, that when our mind is not fully comfortable going into deep meditation initially or even sitting still, and there are some of us who, for various reasons, some of them temperamental, some of them having to do with our life situation, that the same principles of abhyasa and vairagya can be applied to more physical practices, which of course include asana, which for many of you is the gateway practice that brought us into the path in the first place, but which can also involve running, mindful walking or fast walking, dancing, tai chi, all of these physical practices, because obviously the mind and the body are deeply connected, all of these physical practices can potentially quiet the distractions and take us into a still state. And I noticed that when some of the Eastern teachers came to the West, a lot of them noticed that the young seekers who came to meet them, who tended to be enthusiastic but not very practiced, did not do so well in seated meditation. And so many of these teachers offered a strong emphasis on physical practice. You know, Rajneesh, the controversial teacher now known as Osho, emphasized what he called dynamic meditation, where you dance and move and whirl until at a certain point your body just sits down in exhaustion, and at that moment the mind can become still. Yogi Bhajan's Kundalini Yoga tradition uses a lot of physical movements called kriyas, which also can tend to exhaust the body, and as a result, also coax the mind to becoming quiet. My guru emphasized chanting. We always chanted for about 10 minutes before meditation, and a lot of a lot of other times when you lived with him. And he also emphasized seva, karma yoga, which in his world often meant doing tasks that were repetitive and very mundane, including things like sorting beans, and other more obviously productive tasks like working in the garden. The idea being that when you did these tasks in a spirit of offering, they would over time begin to erode mental tendencies like boredom, resentment, and the desire for results. So all of these physical or active practices are also forms of abhyasa, as long as you're doing them with the intention to tune into the still mind. So they may start with a focus on an activity other than meditation, but they all help quiet the flow of thoughts and turn it inward. So what is important, and I can't emphasize this enough, is that the practice you choose at a given moment be one that's appropriate for that moment. So if your mind is very active, a subtle practice might go right by you. And, at such a time, it's really good to start with asana or to start with movement of some kind. It's one of the reasons why I've asked you to do some yoga asana before you sit for meditation this week. And also to remember that spiritual practice is not ever one size fits all. So a good teacher, and Patanjali is a really good teacher, will provide options, different modalities, and also an overall understanding that what matters is not which practice you do on a given day, but whether the practice helps draw the mind inward, helps it focus, and ultimately lets it dissolve into the source. So periodically, we're just going to do that. We're just going to turn inside. And right now, start by feeling the touch of the breath in the nostrils. This has been our core practice this week, and we're going to continue with it, sensing the breath in the nostrils, passing through the area just under the bridge of the nose, into the back of the throat, flowing upwards towards the center of the head. And then as you exhale, feel that whole region of your inner body expanding. This is a bite-sized practice, so you can open your eyes if you like. And again, one of the things that people have been sharing on the listserv is that sometimes we just go into deep meditation the minute I begin talking, so you don't really hear what's going on. So if you're in deep meditation at this moment, I'm going to ring the gong a little louder. And I'm going to ask you to wake up. This is not to say that listening to this call in a meditative state is a bad thing. Actually, it's important to know that even if you don't actually hear what I say, you're still receiving it on a deeper level. And what it means, though, is that you should listen to the talk again later on this week and get the details as well as the shakti of it. So we're going to discuss a couple of the approaches to meditation that Patanjali gives us. But first, I'd really like to speak a little more in depth about the sacred process of Vairagya. the radical non-attachment, which really is the other aspect of serious yogic practice. Now, vairagya is a little bit of an issue for many of us. And the reason is because we tend to think of detachment as something dry, as something which will tend to take us away from the people and things we love. My experience in vairagya is one of my really favorite refuges in life. My experience is that it's actually a very juicy practice, because if we can really do vairagya, if we can really do letting go, starting in meditation and allowing that intention to begin to permeate the rest of our life, practicing vairagya can give us real freedom. And it is one of the biggest antidotes to, let's say, what we could call unnecessary suffering, and even from what we might call necessary suffering. You know, and of course, right now we're all being given a short course in vairagya. We're being asked to realize that, you know, in social distancing, in staying inside, in quarantining, which for a lot of us involves an enormous amount of work and challenge and fear. But, you know, we're having to let go of going out to restaurants, of celebrating Easter with our families, of, you know, doing the Seder table if we're celebrators of Passover, hanging out with friends, hugging our friends when we meet them on the street. So things that we care about are being taken away from us. And this asks for vairagya. It really only works if we're able to practice vairagya. So we're being forced into this amazing modality at this moment. And I think it is actually quite important to take advantage of it, because how many times in your life are you going to have everything taken away from you? Well, not everything, thank God, but are you going to be in this situation in which not just you and I, but pretty much the whole country, in many cases, is being self-isolated. I mean, what a radical moment this is. A real invitation to vairagya. And I want to use the word vairagya rather than the word non-attachment, because there is a real power in the Sanskrit and in getting to know the Sanskrit. You know, languages like English and French and Spanish and Czech and German and Russian and Thai have their own strengths, actually. But subtle language for internal states of awareness is not the forte of most European languages. I suspect that the Thai language has a more subtle has words for more subtle states that maybe we don't have in French or in English. But Sanskrit is actually constructed to describe subtle states of consciousness. And you know, there's most Sanskrit words have at least one meaning that refers to a yogic practice. There's an academic joke about Sanskrit which says that most Sanskrit terms have so many meanings that each one can be used to refer to a deity, an animal, a yogic asana, or a sexual position. So yogic practice is very much a feature of the terms we use in Sanskrit. But Sanskrit is also a language that vibrates in the body in ways that can expand consciousness. So when we use the word vairagya, just say it to yourself, vairagya. See if you can notice the resonance that it has, vairagya. For me, anyway, in my body, the vai vibrates in the chest. Rag vibrates from the chest up through the head. Vairagya. It's very resonant in the inner body. Vairagya comes from the word raga, which means attraction. And raga is the natural pull that is built in to every cell and every particle of this universe, which draws us towards each other, and it exists in an eternal polarity with its equal and opposite force, aversion, which, you know, in Sanskrit the word is dvesha. So raga dvesha, that is attachment and aversion, desire and repulsion are a dyad, like pleasure, pain, praise, blame, joy, sorrow. And these dyads, these oppositions, are called the dwandas, or the pairs of opposites. And it is one of the characteristics of the state of limitation when our consciousness is contracted and we're identified totally with our individual self and not aware of the wholeness. We are said to be caught in the pairs of opposites, up and down, good and bad, all of those dualities. That's the essence of duality. And much of our suffering is tied into our charge around the pairs of opposites, because the nature of life is that it's constantly moving. Shakti is ever-changing, and certainly in her form as the human mind, she brings up an ever-changing array of thoughts and feelings. And so we're constantly being pulled around by the opposites. But raga and its wife or husband, dvesha, are particularly significant. Raga is one of the five core binding qualities, the five kleshas, which we're going to get into in a later class, that literally cage and trap consciousness and cause us to be unable to break out of our identification with our smallness. But even though raga is a binding quality, it also is, as I said earlier, a core aspect of the universe, because what is it that keeps planets spinning in their orbits? It's the force of raga, the force of attachment, you know, that keeps the planets in place, spinning around the sun. They're drawn by the sun, and that keeps them in place. It's what brings atoms together to make molecules, and draws molecules together to make cells, and brings cells together to make living organisms. So attraction, raga, is what draws to us the gifts and people that belong with us. So basically, at every level, from the cosmic to the geological, to the biological, to the psychological, raga, the principle of attraction, and vesha, the principle of aversion, are core to our existence. So we can't really get rid of them. But from the point of view of the yogic enterprise, let's say our attachment to attachment and our attachment to aversion, the level of seriousness with which we take them, are very much part of what keep us stuck on the wheel. So they're, you know, attachment and aversion are both central to life and also harmful. So in all the yogic traditions, but especially in Tantra, our experience of attachment and aversion are what happens when consciousness contracts itself and loses touch with the fundamental sense of complete satisfaction and wholeness that is our real nature and that is characteristic of the source itself. So when we feel like a separate self cut off from the universe, from God and from each other, raga and dvesha become a kind of force field that lies behind our negative and painful samskaras and vasanas. So vairagya is freedom from the pull of raga. It's defined as freedom from desire for what is seen and heard. And for most of us, as we said earlier, life teaches vairagya, because over the course of life, we're going to lose many, many things that matter to us. And I'm not going to give you examples right now, though I could think of about 30 of them. I think you can probably think of your own. But I know it sounds kind of harsh. Every loss is a teaching, because it can be an opportunity to notice the felt sense of attachment and craving and to let it go. And letting go of craving is not the same thing as suppressing emotions. So letting go of craving. Vairagya is not the same thing as, suppressing emotions or suppressing desires or dissociating. You know that joke, how many sons of a Jewish mother does it take to change a light bulb? The answer is, don't worry, I'll just sit here in the dark. So at a practical level, if we're going to succeed at anything in life, and certainly in meditation, we actually have to learn Vairagya. You know, that famous marshmallow experiment. Do you remember that, where kids are left alone in a room with a marshmallow, and the person who's running the experiment tells them that he's going to leave the room, and that if they can resist eating the marshmallow until the facilitator comes back, they'll be rewarded with two marshmallows. Now, the interesting thing is that not every kid can do it. It turns out that the ability to delay eating the marshmallow is predictive of a kid's ability to do well in school and even to be successful in life. So yogic training can be very useful. Learning how to let go, which is really a way of learning how to delay gratification, is incredibly useful on many levels. And obviously in meditation, we cultivate a very specific form of vairagya, but vairagya also applies to all the different levels of yogic discipline, including food discipline, discipline about who we hang out with, what we feed our minds, which TV shows we watch, which news sites we read. So practicing sustainable and intelligent vairagya is a huge part of yogic lifestyle. And this key word, of course, is sustainable. I'm not going to go into the details of that. But, you know, I think most of us have certain habits that are very difficult for us to break. And most of us who actually are successful in, for instance, breaking the processed sugar habit or stopping smoking or, you know, learning to turn off the TV so that we can get to sleep early enough to get up for meditation, we don't do it by completely cutting out these things. We do it gradually. We do it in stages. We do it by substituting one thing for the thing that we're addicted to and then gradually tapering off with that. So the point is that vairagya as a practice is one moment at a time. You know, one moment at a time. You take a breath before you make that critical remark. You do a moment or two of deep yogic breathing instead of eating the extra cookie. Sometimes you blow it, but when you do, you just start again. And of course, that's what we do in meditation. So, you know, you focus. A thought comes up, you get lost in it, you let it go, and little by little, it becomes easier to do that, and there's more and more stillness. So I want to do two vairagya practices right now, both of them classic ways of working with the mind in meditation. The first one is from the Yoga and Vedanta traditions, and the second is from the Vijnana Bhairava Tantra. So I don't know if any of you have ever seen an old Bob Newhart sketch that's actually, you can get on YouTube. It's Bob Newhart was a comedian from the 60s, maybe into the 70s. And in this sketch, he plays a psychiatrist. A young woman comes in to see him, and she's got an emotional problem. She's sitting in front of him crying, and she's talking about how unhappy she is and how she keeps having these bad thoughts. And Bob Newhart says to her, just stop it. And the young woman says, what do you mean stop it? Bob Newhart says, you heard me, stop it. Stop having negative thoughts. She says, but I can't. He says, stop it. So this is this practice. The sketch is hilarious. But what he is actually talking about is a practice that's not necessarily very useful when you're dealing with emotional turmoil that needs some healing, but which is actually quite useful at certain moments in your meditation practice. So here we go. We're going to do stop it as a practice. So find your posture. Your eyes are closed. You're focusing on the feeling of the breath coming in to the nostrils, flowing through the nasal passages up to the center of the head. And then with the exhalation, you just allow the breath to flow naturally through every side of your head and your body. And you can add the mantra Hum Sa to the meditation. Now, the next time a thought other than Hum Sa comes up, just say to yourself, drop it. Drop the thought. Notice the space that arises. Drop the thought. Notice the state space that arises. Now, drop the mantra. Drop it. Are thoughts coming up? Drop them. That's your practice. You're sitting. You're aware of the breath. Thoughts come up. You coach yourself. Drop it. And you do. Drop it. 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 Now just notice how that was for you. I call this warrior mind practice. It's quite hardcore, and it's very characteristic of the hardcore approach to yogic meditation that this text can sometimes be interpreted as promoting. And now we're going to work with a practice that is, I find, more effective, but which is equally aimed at helping the mind let go of thoughts. And this is a practice I learned from my guru quite early in my path. And this is at a time when I had essentially no control whatsoever of my mind. And he said one day in a talk, why do you chase thoughts, trying to make them go away? Don't you understand that it is impossible to eliminate thinking? All your thoughts, he said, are made of Shakti, divine energy, and they're controlled by Shakti. So the primordial goddess, such a radical idea, the primordial goddess who created this universe is also creating the world of thoughts and images and emotions in your mind. So how are you going to fight the creatrix of the world? Instead of trying to get rid of your thoughts, recognize that all your thoughts are made of energy. They're all made of mind stuff. They're all made of consciousness. That table in your mind is not made of wood. It's made of consciousness. It's made of energy. And that energy is Shakti herself. So we're going to try it now and just understand, as I know you do, that seeing thoughts as energy is not the same as letting your mind chase down every stray fantasy. It's actually a moment, a practice for shifting your attachment to thoughts by redefining them. Because, you know, normally we actually believe our thoughts are true. And if you have a thought in your mind like, I'm such a screwed up person, which I think most of us do at one time or another, we tend to believe that thought. And that's how we get so negativized by our samskaras. But if you recognize that this thought is just a manifestation of Shakti, that it has no reality, that it is not true, it's just a thought, it's just made of consciousness, changes your whole attitude towards it. It means you don't have to believe the content. And, you know, as you know, some of our thoughts are very hard to let go of. Among them, the classic critical voices like, you're such a screw-up, or you're a terrible dad, or I'm so lazy, or, you know, that thought like, these people are going to reject me because I was rejected in the second grade and I have a pattern of being rejected, you know, or I'm fat and I hate my body. All those thoughts, as well as the thoughts, you know, like, I'm so special, I'm entitled to more than I get in this life. They're all just thoughts. And later on, Patanjali will give us a method for substituting positive thoughts for negative ones, which is tremendously helpful in daily life. But right now, here's our practice. So come back into your posture. Locate your attention with the breath for a moment or two. But basically, your practice right now is to let the mind do whatever it does. So the mind runs on, the mind goes into a sort of a sleepy state, whatever it wants to do. But you remind yourself, right now, wherever my mind goes is Shakti, is energy. And that energy, at its core, is divine energy, is sacred energy. Essentially, what you're saying is that my mind is sacred, and the thoughts that arise and subside in it are like waves in the ocean of my sacred mind. They rise and they subside. And wherever the mind goes, it is encountering only Shakti, only waves of Shakti. we're going to begin to speak now about some of the modalities that the sage Patanjali gives us for focusing, for concentrating. These are in Sutras 17 and 18, and they describe two forms of deep concentration, which are known as sampragnata samadhi, which means absorption accompanied by awareness of an object. I could call this meditation supported by a form. And the second one is asampragnata samadhi, that is concentration or absorption in the formless, in the state of quiet. Sampragnata samadhi is what most of us experience in a normal deep meditation practice, but it also includes the practices that we use. And this is one of the reasons why this is such a helpful sutra. Asampragnata samadhi is actually the state that arises when the mind has become so absorbed in the form that we lose the sense of separation between ourselves as the meditator and the object of meditation and are just experiencing a wide sense of our own consciousness. So we're going to get into that at a later time. This discussion begins here and it goes on at different points throughout the text. So here's the sutra. Sutra 17 on sampragnata samadhi, the samadhi with form. It goes, vitarka vichara ananda asmita rupa panu gamat. Vitarka vichara ananda asmita rupa nu gamat. Samadhi with form is accompanied or accomplished either by a concrete object, a subtle object, the experience of joy, or the feeling of I am-ness. So in concentrative practice, we're always using a form as a way of transcending form. And even very advanced meditators usually start a meditation session by anchoring their attention in something concrete. So the first level of the practice of sampragnata samadhi is called vitarka, which means concentration on a concrete object. And this sutra can be understood in two ways. First, it describes the stages by which we get absorbed in subtler and subtler objects of focus, but it also includes all the different meditation forms that we might use in meditation. So vitarka starts by anchoring our awareness in something concrete, which could be an object like a flame or a flower or a yantra, one of those painted diagrams that very often connects us to the energy of a particular deity, a special crystal or a stone or a tree or the ocean or the sky or a picture perhaps of a guru or a saint. And, you know, as I list these meditation objects, you probably remember times when you've done that, you know, meditation on a concrete object outside your body. But an even more, or I should say, I don't mean but, I mean and, an even more helpful object of meditation, concrete object of meditation, is the body itself. And any part of the body will do. One of the reasons that I really like meditation on the body, or meditation on an aspect of the body, or the breath, which is both outside the body and inside the body, is because the physical body is the outer layer of our subtle self. So when we meditate on the body or in the body, for instance, in the practice of mindfulness, which is, of course, the form of meditation that has you know, kind of become so popular in the mainstream that almost everybody I meet who meditates is doing a form of mindfulness. And one of the main forms of mindfulness, as you know, is mindfulness of the body, where we bring our attention successively to different parts of the body, the toes, the ankles, the calves, the hips, the heart, etc. You know, we move our attention through the body as you do in a guided Shavasana. And what happens as you do that is that the mind becomes often more and more subtle as your meditation in the body connects you to subtle sensation and to the subtle body. Of course, the famous practice of yoga nidra is a perfect example of that, because you go in yoga nidra, you go from focusing on the weight of the body, the heaviness of the body, the lightness of the body, then to subtler, more imaginative ways of holding the mind. And what I always notice when I do meditation on the body, when I start by meditating on the body, that what begins to happen, especially when you're involving the breath in your focus, is that I begin to become sort of naturally aware of the subtle sensations in the body. And that experience of sensation actually starts to bring my mind more deeply inside. So our meditation of focusing on the breath and the nostrils is, of course, a classic mindfulness practice in which we simply use the natural motion of the breath in the nostrils, the breath touching the body, to focus the mind and also to awaken delight and restfulness in the beginning of practice. I'm going to ask you to just return your practice to mindfulness of breath, to just feeling the touch of the breath in the nostrils, feeling it flowing inward, and I'm going to talk while you're doing it, while asking you to do a kind of split focus where part of your attention is on the sensation of breath and even on the sensual caress of the breath, your body opening up to receive the breath. But notice how the breath and the body tend to anchor your awareness and keep it focused. As the focus establishes itself, as many of you have found in this week's practice, is that the touch of the breath begins to come to the forefront of our awareness. So we're not so much aware of the body as such, of the body as an object, but actually of the sensation of breath as it moves through and opens these different parts of the body. And for many of you, this opens it into quite a subtle experience of pure energy. So we may be directing the breath through the nasal passages to the center of the head, and these are concrete, physical, perceptible objects. But we're also getting more and more sensitive as we feel the inside of the nasal passages, which not all of us are used to doing in daily life, and the center of the head. But at some point, as several of you have shared, this simple breath meditation is going to lead you to get a sense of this subtle resonance or openness or space in the head that is called the Ajna Chakra, subtle energy center located in the space in the middle of the head. Some people find that space closer to the forehead. Some people, me being one of them, find that space in the very center of the head above the soft palate. And eventually, the focus on the physical connection between breath and body will draw you into an awareness of the subtle centers that are being opened up, essentially the chakras. And in our meditation practice, eventually the breath will begin to feel as though it's kind of expanding the borders, the boundaries of the body, and actually connecting us to the air, connecting us to the heart center, connecting us to subtle aspects of ourselves. So, and at that point, as we begin to feel the subtlety of the breath and the rising of what's sometimes called the inner breath, the subtle prana that breathing practice activates, we find ourselves in a state of greater subtlety, meditating on a subtle object, in this case the inner breath or the chakra. And this meditation on a subtle object is called vichara. Vichara. Again, there are classic objects of vichara. For instance, meditation on the flame in the heart, which is an imagine, obviously, when you meditate on a flame in the heart, you're creating that flame as a visual, you're doing it in the imagination, but it becomes a subtle object. And sometimes if you're meditating on a physical candle flame, what happens after a while is that your eyes close and you begin to see the after image of that flame, which you can then place in the heart, and then you're meditating on the subtle residue of the flame. Similarly, with a yantra or a photograph of your guru or a picture of the goddess. And what begins to happen as your meditation becomes not on a physical representation of goddess, but on your imaginary expression or cultivation of the goddess form or the feeling of the goddess, you find yourself that you're in a much more subtle state. And again, this process of subtilizing your attention will happen no matter what you're meditating on. It naturally will start to draw your awareness into a subtler experience. And for many of us, and again, this is utterly classical in so many traditions, the subtle object is a mantra. And we're going to talk about mantra in more detail and in more depth next week. But I want to bring it up here because, first of all, many of you have quite a lot of direct experience of how, of what happens when the mind gets absorbed in the mantra. And at the beginning, a mantra as a subtle object is a cognitive focusing device, an alternative thought that captures the mind's thinking tendency and can start to move our nervous system into the parasympathetic rather than having it stuck in the sympathetic, which is our more outgoing state. And one of the principles of mantra meditation is that even though we can use any word as a focal point, Patanjali and all the sages define mantra as a word that is a name of the divine, a name of God, a name of goddess, a name of the self. The one Patanjali specifically mentions is Om. And such a mantra like Om or Shrim or Hamsa or Om Namah Shivaya or any of the other great mantras that connect our minds to the sacred are literally sound forms of divine states of awareness or of deity forms. And as I say, we'll get into this in a later class. The tantras have the most powerful explanations of this, but it's also in Patanjali. So these sacred sound forms are like supra-biological particles or energy packets that literally plug into receptors in the subtle and causal bodies and naturally turn our attention away from the exterior and begin to show us the sacred presence that is inside our body. Just, it happens, it works. You know, like many of you, I've been studying viruses the last few weeks. So just the way viruses hook into the DNA of cells and change the way the cells express themselves, mantras hook into the subtle cellular structure of your energy body, and they literally shed a viral load of sacred energy into the body, mind, heart, opening the chakras, alchemizing your chitta, so that it gains this power to turn back into its source. And of course, this is particularly true if the mantra that you're working with is a lineage mantra that comes from an enlightened lineage, because such a mantra has a heightened power to dissolve samskaras and vasanas. It is, I would say, probably the most powerful immediate practice other than immersion in pure awareness for clearing out the mind field. I want to read you a paragraph from an old friend of mine about his first experience of immersion in the mantra Om Namah Shivaya. He'd been going through a really hard time, and he was feeling extremely depressed and scared. So he told his teacher about it. His teacher was my teacher, which is how come I know this story. And his teacher told him to spend a few days repeating the mantra Om Namah Shivaya all the time. Some of you have done this and perhaps continue to do it. So here's what he said. I repeated the mantra inwardly while visualizing the letters. I carefully note its effect. As I become quiet, I notice that the mantra stirs an unmistakable vibration in my third eye. Every repetition increases this vibration. I observe that each individual mantra is a little package of Shakti. The vibration moves downward to my heart and upward to the Sahasrara. And if you like, you can say the mantra Hamsa as though you were following his instructions, because this sharing actually contains an invitation. So the vibration moves downward to my heart and upward to the Sahasrara. It spreads and increases until I feel a pulsation everywhere. Each repetition feels like a breath that nourishes and recharges every cell in my body. It feels as though my chemical makeup is being transfigured. As the energy collects in my head, I pass into a meditative trance. So just for a moment, inhale with hum, exhale with sa, and feel the pulsations of this mantra, which is one of the mantras of my guru lineage. Feel those vibrations flowing through your system. My friend writes, within 2 days, everything inside me has shifted. The fear has left me. My mind feels clear. I can feel bubbles of joy coming up in my heart. I realize I have had a major breakthrough. Never before have I ever overcome so severe a depression by internal means. Always before, I had used drugs, alcohol, or various diversions. This time, it's by mantra alone that I've shifted. So once again, find the mantra. Marry it to the breath. And as you repeat it, have this feeling that, because it's true, that every repetition of the mantra is eliminating not just the obvious thought forms, but the buried samskaras and even the vasanas that you cannot reach by any other means. I've been using mantra as a practice to cure negative states for about 40 years, and I can tell you that, and I know many of you have the same experience, that it absolutely clears the mind. And it doesn't, I'm not suggesting that mantra is a substitute for antidepressant medication when that's what you need, but really not at all. If you're on medication, please don't stop your medication when you start practicing mantra. But in any ordinary dark mood, especially in those moods that come up when we're doing deep practice, mantra is probably the most effective and immediate antidote that the yoga tradition offers, no matter what stage of practice we're in. It's available to everyone. It requires no special skill, and it really, really works. So mantras carry a double whammy, first because they turn the mind in, second because a mantra like Hamsa is a powerful container for the Shakti of a lineage, which is one of the most crucial forms of grace that we can connect to. We'll talk about this again later on, but what I often say and feel is that the mantra given by a lineage-connected teacher is actually a repository of liberating Shakti that acts like a rope line that, to mix a few metaphors, it guides you up the mountain of awareness, or it guides you deep into the cave of the heart until you reach the source. It will take you to the source. And once it reaches the subtle source, it starts to dissolve. And this will happen sometimes fairly early in your meditation session as the mantra melts the mind back into itself. And one of the ways you feel that happening, or that you know that happening, especially in the Shaktified lineages like ours, you might experience one of the classic symptoms of heightened Shakti. Your body might sway, or you might feel a lot of energy rising. You might shake. You might weep. But what probably is the most common experience, and, you know, to my mind, one of the most divine experiences that occurs when we practice mantra, is that this very pleasant feeling starts to arise, which can swiftly expand into a palpable feeling of bliss. And it's that blissful feeling that ushers us into the next stage of meditation. Because when you merge the mind in a subtle object, sooner or later, it will put you in touch with the ananda, the subtle enjoyment that lies buried within us and that which is really the footprint of the primordial Shakti. And then the tactic in meditation, the next stage of meditation, is to focus on the feeling of bliss, which can manifest as peace, peacefulness, or as a simple feeling of contentment, or just as a kind of a pleasant sensation. That's a form of bliss. You know, bliss is a very big word, and many of us imagine that the feeling of blissfulness is like, you know, the feeling you get when you've taken a large dose of ecstasy, MDMA, or, you know, which is the psychedelic love drug. That definitely gives you the experience of bliss, at least as long as you're high on it. But your bliss doesn't have to be that dramatic, and it certainly doesn't have to be that romantic. It can manifest as just a very sweet feeling. And when, you know, this question arises, which comes up a lot, what should I do if the mantra disappears and I can't repeat it anymore, or is there a point where I should let go of the technique? The answer to both questions is yes. When that subtle feeling of pleasure arises, you can, and the mantra or the visualization starts to dissolve, it's a signal that your meditation is flowing into the ananda level of practice, of concentration. And at that point, you might just want to let yourself be. If thoughts grab you, you can breathe them out, do a little vairagya, or go back to the technique that feels appropriate. But this is the all-important transition stage between effortful meditation and effortless meditation. And the knowing how to navigate it means knowing how to tune into this wordless sense of presence, which is another word for ananda, and open into it. In tantric lineages, bliss is considered to be one of the absolutely crucial focal points for practice because, in my view and my experience, ananda, bliss, is a synonym for shakti. In other words, ananda is the energetic current that starts to arise in meditation as we move deeper inside. And that energetic current has an innately pleasurable quality to it, which is there even when a lot of crap is coming up in meditation. If you really tune into the underlying felt sense of your inner being when you're in meditation, even if there's a particularly gnarly memory arising, you'll notice that behind it all, you know, as your meditation gets deeper, there is this feeling of, I would call it fundamental okayness. And if we can take refuge in it, even if the energy feels strong, it will pretty much effortlessly carry you deeper. There will be times when the sense of energy in your body is so strong that it doesn't feel good. But generally speaking, when we have that experience, it's because we're not used to that level of energy. And if you can take rest in the felt sense of the shakti, even strong shakti, it will start to open and you'll begin to experience its pleasurable core. And for me, meditation on bliss really has always been associated with the energy that arises through mantra. And it's one of the reasons why I just believe mantra to be such an incredibly powerful practice for pretty much anybody. Even though there are certainly traditions, the Zen Buddhist tradition is one that essentially distrust bliss. And, you know, often if you're a Zen practitioner, you'll hear from your teachers that when bliss arises, you should drop it. You should transcend it. You should regard it as a way station and not the goal. And the tantricas disagree with that. The tantricas actually experience the deepest level of reality as being innately blissful. Bliss is shakti, according to the tantricas. And the Patanjali tradition does not disagree. So even though there are many levels of bliss, it should be recognized as the footprint of the primordial shakti. And as many of you know, in the tantric meditation texts like the Vijnana Bhairava, there are several practices for tuning into the felt experience of sensory enjoyment, such as the pleasure in tasting something delicious, or the pleasure in sexual arousal, or the pleasure of listening to music, or the pleasure that you get from looking at something beautiful, or, you know, that first bite of chocolate mousse. These are doorways to the higher bliss. If you know how to do the vairagya practice, which is crucial, where you let go of your attachment to the sensory experience that's triggered the bliss and really focus on enjoyment itself. So in a non-dual universe, sensual enjoyment is one of the most accessible levels of, it's one of the most accessible levels and doorways into the primordial joy that's our essence. So see if at this moment, as you focus on the breath, and perhaps on the mantra Hamsa, you can tune into the pleasure, this very subtle sense of pleasure that arises from the touch of the breath, that arises from the touch of the mantra on your inner body. Can you make that pleasurable experience the focus of your meditation? Now, as your attentiveness to Ananda, to the peaceful, contented, pleasurable experience that arises in meditation, as it becomes subtler, we begin to get a felt sense of being itself. On the felt sense of our own existence as an I. And this is called, when we get fully absorbed in our own I sense, it's called asmita samadhi, or absorption in the pure feeling of I am. Absorption in your I-ness is actually the subtlest form of concentrative samadhi. And it's sometimes called, and those of you who have done a lot of spiritual reading will recognize this term, it's sometimes called atma vichara, or concentration on the self. My guru used to say, this was his primary teaching, meditate on yourself. Worship yourself. Honor yourself, your atma, your I sense, because God, the supreme reality, lives within you as your own sense of I am. So absorption in the I sense is absorption in the felt experience of being yourself. And when we first start intellectually trying to understand this practice, we'll often ask ourselves, and I did for a long time, like, what is it? You know, what do they mean? What do they mean by the I am sense? And I would imagine that it was something very esoteric, something very out of reach, a special state. Actually, it isn't. I mean, it becomes a special state when we meditate on it, for sure. It's a doorway to a really strong experience of awakening to the truth of the self. But at the same time, it's this very basic feeling of your own aliveness that, you know, it's been there ever since you came to consciousness. And you feel it if you notice when you wake up tomorrow morning, you notice that there is this moment before you actually become aware of your body and where you are in the room. There's this moment when you just have an inchoate feeling of being something, being yourself, being an I, being a self experiencing your own aliveness. And this is a common or garden variety experience of original mind, of the true Atman, or as the Christian mystics say, of the soul. So the trick, the secret of asmita meditation is to remove your sense of I from identifying with anything but itself. We actually do a meditation that many of you have done with me, which you can do at a, you know, pretty initial stage of practice, and we'll do it now for a moment. Where you just close your eyes. Don't worry about getting into an upright posture. Just as you inhale, have the feeling, I am. I exist. see if you can feel into the feeling of I am. Thoughts will definitely come up, including, if you're not used to this practice, thoughts like, what does that mean, I am? How do I find it? So my suggestion is that you treat any of these thoughts as distractions, breathe them out, and see if you can feel into the subtle felt sense of being, of existence. We might call it presence. And if that's hard to do, then use the words, I am. Inhale with the thought, I am. And then just be aware of the space that arises in the wake of it. I am. What does the mind feel like? At the moment after the I am thought has dissolved. See if you can keep this sense of I am-ness present as you listen to the rest of this talk. You know, many of you are aware of the different ways we tune into the I am presence, whether it's with the practice we just did or by practice that is part of our homework and that we worked with last week of asking yourself, who knows, I'm meditating, and then focusing on what arises. Or the classic inquiry of Ramana Maharshi, which is the inquiry into the nature of the I. You ask yourself, who am I really? And then you focus on the space that's left by those words, by that question. But the actual experience of asmita, absorption in the I, is wordless. And it does actually tend to arise naturally as you go deep in meditation. So this sutra actually reveals to us the whole process that begins when we sit for meditation. Vitarka, vichara, ananda, asmita rupanugamat. Absorption with form is accompanied by either a concrete object, a subtle object, joy, or the feeling of I am-ness. The so-called higher samadhi, or asamprajnata samadhi, the formless absorption, is actually the natural result of this practice of meditation with objects. And this is pretty subtle, but I want to take you through it. As we practice, And as the mind gets more immersed in the breath, in the mantra, in the felt sense of Shakti, in the feeling of being, there is an actual shift in consciousness, which my friend was describing in the mantra share that, you know, I read earlier. The particles of our consciousness, instead of being colored as they normally are by the various stresses of our activities, of our perceptions, our accumulated thought forms, begin to let go of these obstructions, because that's what they are, of these kind of clogging qualities, and begin to reveal their real nature, our consciousness, the real nature of our consciousness, and its qualities of clarity, intelligence, and openness. Our consciousness starts to become a reflective lens that the seer can shine through, as Sutra 3 says. And for many of us, when you get to that point where the thought forms start to quiet down, you'll often experience a subtle wall, a block, a kind of opaqueness in your consciousness, which essentially stops you from moving farther inside. And it's that block, that wall, which keeps us feeling separate from the ocean of expanded consciousness, which is the real nature of the mind. And often when you get deep in meditation, you sense that there's an expansion that's just out of reach. And, you know, this is normal. The reason it's normal is because when we're actually practicing, there is always a subtle feeling of being a person doing a practice. You know, when you remember the object, you remember to let go of thoughts, there's a part of your mind that's commenting. And this is all a natural part of abhyasa. These are called samskaras of effort. You know, they're making effort create samskaras. And we need them because they help us make intelligent effort. You know, we need to pay attention. But at a certain point, what we realize we need to do is to let go of effort and just be present in the process, because the samskara of making effort is a block to actually settling into the depth of meditation. I know you know what I mean, because if you're a deep meditator, you're going to experience that there is this moment when you realize that the effort itself has become a block. You may not characterize it that way, but you know, you'll notice that you're just, you know, your mind is trying, you're making an effort, and that it's kind of blocking your absorption. So this is the point, this is one of the points where we can start to begin to practice subtler forms of vairagya. The way I often work with the sense of blockage, or of being, you know, kind of knocked, let's say, filled up by the residue of my effort, is I begin to focus on the exhalation, to flow with the exhalation until the point where the exhalation starts to dissolve in space, and to accompany this focus on the exhalation, which is very subtle, needs to be very subtle, with the intention to let go, to release, to relax. It's a process that's sometimes called ego relaxation. And it's something that you can teach yourself. So right now, again, focus on the breath. But instead of focusing on the inhalation, let the inhalation happen naturally and follow subtly the movement of the exhalation until it dissolves, and you don't have to prolong the exhalation, just follow it. and let your attention tune into the place where the exhalation is dissolved, just for a second, with the intention that you're going to let go. And don't try to interrupt the breathing process. The inhalation will arise. But then with the next exhalation, have the feeling that the exhalation is a process of letting go. And let yourself rest for a second or two in that space at the end of the exhalation. If you're prompted to soften the body, soften the belly, soften the shoulders, soften the face, consider that also a practice of letting go. And this is the moment to let yourself be. To just relax in the space at the end of the exhalation for as long as it's there, with no forcing, with no specific intention. Just allowing yourself to be and noticing how then when the breath begins to move again, the sense of being is still there. So what you may notice as we go through this process is that even as you're aware of this place of stillness, that thoughts may still be arising in the mind. The mind may not be empty, but the quality of the thoughts is different. They're not sticky in the same way. They can flow. They can arise and subside. And one of the misconceptions that we often get from a superficial reading of the Yoga Sutras is this belief that we are failing at meditation if the mind doesn't immediately become still. But the fact is that this is absolutely untrue. And one of the ways we know this is that when you come out of meditation, even if your mind hasn't felt still, there's usually a sense of clarity and well-being that, you know, as a regular meditator, many of you know this, it's really the effect of daily meditation. It's one of the reasons why we love to meditate in the morning, because it sets us up for a better day. And one of the effects of daily meditation practice is that in the process of sinking the mind again and again into the states of vitarka, vichara, ananda, asmita, absorption in an object, in a subtle object, like a mantra, in the felt sense of Shakti, in the feeling of I-ness, we start to become aware of a layer of our chitta, which is clear and smart in a way that we may not necessarily experience normally. In other words, what we begin to have access to is the intuitive discernment, which the Yoga Sutras call prajna, P-R-J-N-A. It's a really important idea. Prajna is a type of pure knowing. It's awareness unencumbered by speculation or thought forms. It's the innate capacity of your consciousness to know what's true. And it's one of your superpowers. Because prajna doesn't need the thinking mind or the senses to operate. It just knows. And it's when you know, as many of you do, and as I often do, when you take a question into meditation and you go deep, or you go into a meditative space, you'll very often come out of meditation and you'll have an answer to the question. You didn't think about it. You didn't spend your meditation thinking about it. But asking the question activated the prajna, and the answer arises. So actually, one of the signs that your meditation practice is progressing is that you begin to have access, not all the time, but fairly regularly, to this innate intuitive skill, and it becomes more and more available to you as meditation clears out the samskaras. Because as you meditate, your consciousness loses its density over time, and you begin to experience the freedom of your own mind. And when that happens, those skills that have arisen in meditation actually begin to be felt and experienced during the rest of your life. So I'm going to introduce five sutras that we'll begin to investigate during the homework, and that we'll get into more next week. And these are the sutras 23 through 27, which are the sutras on surrender and devotion that absolutely permeate the teachings of the Yoga Sutras, and which are the basis of all kinds of mystical traditions. So Sutra 23 says, Ishvara Pranidhanadva. Samadhi also comes from surrender to Ishvara. Ishvara is a word for God. Another way of translating this sutra, which I like, is total inward clarity is reached by placing oneself in the Lord, in God. Ishvara, who can also be called Ishwari, meaning goddess, is a unique self untouched by afflictions, karmas, the results of karmas, or the repository of karmas. Ishvara is the one who has been the teacher of all previous teachers. So in other words, Ishvara is the inner guru. Ishvara is the inner deity. Ishvara is the inner God. The personal God form, the inner, I'm going to say this, and I hope you get it. I want to explain it more carefully, but we don't really have time to do it tonight, but we definitely will do it as we go on. Ishvara is the other, the divine other, who lives inside you and who is both a form of your inner self and also a divine form, a divine other whom you can take refuge in, ask for help, surrender to, and feel protected by. And this is one of the great paradoxes of human life, that when we say, as my guru used to say, divine consciousness, God, lives within you as you, what he was talking about and what the sutras are talking about and what really all the great Eastern traditions talk about is that though your expanded consciousness is itself divine, that it is also possible to experience the divine as a personal deity form and as a way of focusing on a form in such a way that you're able to experience the fact that you are not alone in the cosmos. This is consciousness as the great father, the great mother, the great spiritual friend, the great teacher, the divine lover, who begins to become present in us, especially when we're able to tune into the inner heart. And the key, the major practice for tuning into Ishwara, into the personal deity aspect of your consciousness, is through mantra. In Sutra 127, specifically speaks of the pranava, which is the syllable om, or the goddess pranava, hrim. Pranava, meaning mantra, is the denoter of Ishwara. The word pranava literally means that which is astonishingly and precisely and uniquely new. It is the ever-fresh experience of the self, the utterly unboring, utterly adorable and fascinating experience of the self. Pandit Rajmani, in his commentary, translates pranava as, quote, the power that breathes unique and transformative newness into us. So pranava is another name for the enlightening mantra. So the word Ishwara, which, as we said, is usually translated as Lord, or if you're a goddess practitioner, as Lady. Ishwara and Ishwari are the masculine and feminine forms of this multi-leveled inner deity. And Ishwara in Shaivism, in non-dual Shaivism, is a slightly less subtle aspect of the primordial Shiva Shakti, or absolute reality, which appears as consciousness begins the process of manifesting universes. Ishwara is an aspect of consciousness which is fully aware of its wholeness, which is fully empowered, which has omniscience, omnipotence, complete self-satisfaction, a vast array of powers and an unspeakable capacity for love. And in different traditions, this form, Ishwara, the we could call it the avatar, the icon of total reality, which can be experienced both as a feeling or an energy, but also as a being, like Shiva or Krishna or Durga or Lakshmi. Or if you're a Christian, as Christ consciousness, if you're Jewish, as Elohim. In these religions, and certainly in Judaism, there's not a focus on meditation and form, more a sense of Ishvara as a felt experience of personal God whom we pray to. And so this sutra, Ishvara Pranidhan, leads to samadhi, taking refuge, surrender into personal deity. It's one of the keys to samadhi. It's in some aspects of this tradition, we say that if you can fully surrender to grace, fully surrender to the energy of Ishvara, which is experienced traditionally in the heart, but which is not confined to the heart, which surrounds us, totally fills us with the experience of grace and protection when we know how to tune into it, then we can turn to that sense of deity, of embodied love, of subtle, empowered protection. Take refuge in it. Place ourselves in the mind and heart of Ishvara. And we will literally be carried by that sense of presence. So, as we close, let's tune into this mystical dimension of the Yoga Sutras. You don't have to conceive of Ishvara as a personal being, as a being with a particular form. Simply have this thought, I place my heart and mind in the heart and mind of the great consciousness, which is both my source and my beloved, my protector, my mother, father, friend. I take rest in the heart and mind of Ishvara. Of the radiant light of the divine. I take refuge in that divine presence which knows me, which loves me, which is personally ready to receive me. I offer my samskaras, my fears, my aspirations, my effort. I offer all this into the heart and mind of the divine. And I relax into the presence of grace. Please take this awareness. I place myself in the mind heart of the divine into your day or your evening. This audio will be available tomorrow. Your homework will come tomorrow. And we're going to be having a question and answer session on Sunday at noon U.S. Pacific time. And we'll be sending you an announcement of that. Thank you so much for being here and for the practice that you're doing. Even single meditation session is going to have a 20-minute meditation. It's going to have an immeasurable effect on your life and on your consciousness. Namaste. So much love to all of you.
Tamasu.